Welcome to the Progressive Beat. I'm John Neuroer, and today my co-host Christy Harvey and I drop in on an event with House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer talking about failed conservative policies of the last 8 years. We also drop in on a conference call with economic experts talking about the $700 billion bailout and what it could mean both to Main Street and to Wall Street. And Christy and I talk about some of the stories that may not be on the front page, but you should definitely be paying attention to. It's all here on this week's Progressive Beat. Now we're going to listen in on the opening remarks of House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, who is speaking at the Center for American Progress Action Fund today about the failed conservative policies over the last 8 years. Let's listen in.
Thank you very much, Winnie. I'm pleased to be here. I have a speech, and this is on failures. But as we were coming in, Rob, who works for me and participates in putting together comments, said, you know, really, we don't need to do this speech. We just need to have people read the paper every day, which is a litany of failures, unfortunately for our country and unfortunately for the American people. I want to thank John Podesta for his leadership, Winnie, yours as well, and for giving me this opportunity. The story goes that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, one of America's great leaders over a number of decades, was in a heated argument with one of his colleagues, and after 10 minutes or so, the other senator threw up his hands and said, "You may disagree with me, but I'm entitled to my own opinion," to which Senator Moynihan replied, "Well, yes, you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts." That is a critical concept, I think, for us to hold to. I'm here today to talk about the record of the last 8 years and what we can learn from it. But on a more basic level, I'm here to stand up for the principle that facts are common property. Politics does not work without a shared picture of the world as it is. But unless we start from that common picture, we'll spend our time shouting at each other from two sides of a chasm. More and more, politics is departing from a shared language. We've all seen it. Each side with its own talking heads, its own websites, its own cable shows, and in the end, its own private reality. And when you concede that reality is relative, what do we have left to coax people over from one side of the divide to the other? An impoverished political language that results inevitably in bad policy. The kind you can enact when you never have to win anyone over on the merits. But I have faith in the facts, and the dominant fact of the last 8 years is the unprecedented dominance of conservatism, or at least something that's been parading around as conservatism, while Edmund Burke slowly rotates in his grave. At any rate, Republicans got 8 years in the White House, 6 years with all the levers of power, by one of the most at least articulated conservative administrations, something that not even Ronald Reagan had. And in that time, the ideology that so many had honed for so long had its definitive test. And what was the result? I suggest government malpractice, serial failure, a failure that came about not in spite of but because of modern conservative ideology. Republicans have clearly failed on the economy. Conservative philosophy has been instinctively set against responsible oversight and consumer protection. John McCain's an excellent example. This year he told the Wall Street Journal, "I am fundamentally a deregulator." That is the message that Republicans have been sending to the markets. We see the results. In 2005, the White House helped quash reform of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which turned out to be at the heart of this month's financial crisis. Mike Oxley, the chairman of the Banking Committee, commented relatively colorfully on that opposition of the administration to the regulatory proposals made by Mr. Oxley and the Republicans who were then in charge of Congress. Republicans failed to prevent the abusive lending practices at the root of the subprime debacle, and regulators did not enforce the laws that were in place. As the housing bubble grew, the push for deregulation grew with it. The administration and its allies in the Congress handed out exemptions from anti-predatory lending laws to the biggest financial players in the country. And while exotic financial products were proliferating, Common sense oversight failed to keep up. Indeed, most, including those who proliferated, were not sure they understood the documents and the processes they had created. During the years of this neglect, with the referees taken off the field and kept off the field, a crisis was building in America. I make the observation that when you take referees off the field, the game becomes chaotic. It becomes unfair. And indeed, those who suffer most when the referees are off the field are the little people on the field. Today, we see the results. Mass foreclosures, the worst decline in the housing market since the Great Depression, and now a meltdown on Wall Street, for which taxpayers are being asked to pick up the tab. Conservative philosophy says that tax cuts are a panacea in times of recession and in times of growth, even when they help create a 1920s level of inequality, even when they drive up us deeper and deeper into debt. Even John McCain's senior economic advisor admitted that we simply cannot afford another round of tax cuts. So why push them, he was asked. Because, he said, and I quote, it's the brand, and you don't dilute the brand. We're seeing a debate now in the Congress as the Republican administration is asking its conservative supporters in the Congress to take actions that they intuitively believe are wrong. And they are saying, but that does not consistent is not consistent with our brand. Unfortunately, however, not all conservatives are as forthcoming as that economic advisor's admission. It wasn't that long ago that Minority Leader John Boehner said, and I quote, the pro-growth economic policies put in place by Republicans are working as planned to spur economic growth and reduce the deficit. Working as planned. 3.4 million more Americans are unemployed since President Bush took office. He is one of only four presidents in the last half century to preside over an average annual increase in poverty. At the same time, household income is down. Home foreclosures are at a record high. On the budget, Dick Cheney declared some years ago, deficits don't matter. Republicans pursued that philosophy with a vengeance, and unfortunately, consumers and the corporate world, as well as the public world, took that message to heart. This administration swung the Clinton surplus $10 trillion from $5.6 trillion, and now with the present proposal that's on the floor, to $11.3 trillion of debt, almost exactly doubling the national debt in 90 months. Now, because of record debt and foreign borrowing that exceeded the total of the first 42 administrations combined, we have passed the bill to our children and to our grandchildren. Republicans have failed as well on energy. Of course, that depends on your perspective. If you're an oil corporation and you saw the Cheney meetings of the oil executives on energy policy, perhaps you would say it was a success. After all, you're making the highest profits you've ever made in history. But for the rest of us, it's been pointed out that after 9/11, President Bush had an opportunity to call us to energy independence, to break the oil addiction that he spoke of, that funds dictators and terrorists alike. But instead, he called on us to do what? To go shopping. They passed a bill in 2005 and said that would give us energy independence and bring prices down. Unfortunately, they were wrong. Since President Bush took office, the cost of gas is up nearly 150%. Indeed, it went up more than that, down a little bit now, has spiked yesterday. We'll see what happens. In the minority, Republicans have voted against nearly every single piece of legislation we brought to the floor to confront high gas prices. Why? Because the conservative philosophy told them they should not intervene on speculation, they should not intervene on price gouging, while indeed that philosophy apparently was left unchanged by the fact that before Ike reached Galveston, prices spiked $5. Nevertheless, the conservatives in the Congress voted against legislation to try to put some cap on that gouging of the American public. In addition, they failed on health care. Accepting the Republican nomination in 2004, President Bush said, and I quote, "In a new term, we will lead an aggressive effort to enroll millions of poor children who are eligible but not signed up for government health insurance programs." But when the president vetoed the bill that accomplished that commitment of adding millions of children, he simply said that they can go to the emergency room. That same SCHIP expansion he called for when he was trying to get reelected, he vetoed. House Republicans sustained that veto, and because of them, today, 4 million children are without health insurance that they would have had had that bill, redeeming the president's commitment of 2004, gone into law. In addition, it seems to me and others, they failed on foreign policy. It, too, is a story of failed promises and baseless predictions. As America began the Iraq War, Donald Rumsfeld predicted it could last 6 days, 6 weeks, I doubt 6 months. I don't need to remind any of you in this room, or indeed the American public, that war has stretched on longer than World War II, costing more than 4,000 American lives and over $600 billion and rising, and stretching our military to a breaking point. Meanwhile, Afghanistan smolders and al-Qaeda is regrouping. Last but not least, they have failed us with their abuse of power. Honestly, it's not much of a surprise if your ideology is founded on a basic disdain for government. Governing gets subordinated to scoring political points, handing friends cushy jobs, funneling money to the well-connected. No-bid contracts in Iraq. You can draw a straight line from Ronald Reagan's declaration that government is the problem, to the U.S. Attorney's firings, to political hirings at the Justice Department, to corruption and drugs in the Interior Department, to waste, fraud, and abuse, and no-bid contracts in Iraq, all the way to heck of a job, Brownie. I won't pretend that abuses don't happen in both sides. They do. But I do argue that they will be much more egregious on the side with contempt for government in its political DNA, and the past years have borne that out. That is my view of the last 8 years. And I have a card that I carry around that I would like to relate to you. Some of you have heard me before. But when you look at the facts, as I started with Senator Moynihan's facts, annoying, sometimes debilitating to your argument, but nevertheless, facts will lead us to better policy. When you look at the facts and you look at the comparison of the last 8 years on the previous 8 years, where a different philosophy maintained, they're pretty stark. Median household income under Bill Clinton went up 1.6%. Under this president, went down 1%. Excuse me, 0.1%. Under the first President Bush, by the way, median household income declined 0.8%. Poverty in America under Bill Clinton went down 3.5%. Under this conservative government, went up 1.2%. A philosophy that was supposed to grow the economy, create jobs. Jobs, certainly a claim of this administration on its economic policy, would expand jobs. In point of fact, under Bill Clinton, during the similar period of time, we created 20.8 million jobs. And when I say we, our economy, the private sector, the creation of an environment in which venture capitalists felt comfortable that they could put their capital at risk and not lose because of inflation or fiscal policies at the national level. An average creation of jobs of 216,771 per month. Now, in America, you need about 100,000 jobs per month to stay even. with the growth of those who are looking for jobs. This administration, notwithstanding its economic policies, has created an average of 36,846 jobs per month. And in this period of time, the first 8 months of this year, when compared with the first 8 months of the last year of the Clinton administration, the difference is 1.4 million new jobs created in the first 8 months of the last year of the Clinton administration. This administration has lost over 500,000 jobs in that same period of time, a net turnaround of 2 million jobs just in the last year of the comparative administrations. When you look at real GDP, that is how fast our economy has grown. Under Bill Clinton, it was 3.6%. Under President Bush, over the last 8 years, it's grown 2.5%, a little less than that. The uninsured, as you know, have grown. But when he mentioned the Dow, of course, is an indication of the confidence of the American public in our economy. To some degree, obviously, the NASDAQ and the S&P is as well. They are a stark example of the facts pointing to the failures of this president's economic program. To give you a comparison, under President Bush, the first President Bush, the Dow rose 47% in those 10 years, about 10% a year. Under this president, the Dow is now approximately 4% above what it was on January 1st, 2001, or January 21st, 2001, which means, in light of about a 20 to 25% inflation, that every American who had savings or investment in some kind of KEO plan, 401k plan, or a pension plan that had its investments in the stock market has essentially seen their savings and pensions reduced by about 25%. Under Bill Clinton, as a comparison, 47% under President Bush, 4% currently as of today under President Bush the second. Under Bill Clinton, the Dow went up 226%. 4% versus 226%. A stark fact that I think speaks to the point. Now that the Dow is not alone. The NASDAQ. Under Bill Clinton, the NASDAQ went up 297%. Under this president, with the philosophy that has been pursued from an economic policy standpoint, supposedly to spur the economy and create confidence in the economy, the NASDAQ went down 18%. That is a difference of 315%. The S&P, Standard & Poor 500, under Bill Clinton, went up during the 8 years of his presidency 210%, and under this president has gone down 8%, or a 218% difference to the negative. When you look at fiscal policy, this president predicted that his conservative investment and tax cut philosophy would grow our economy and balance our budget. I have served in the Congress for 28 years. 19 and a half of those have been with Republican presidents, 8 years with the Democratic president. The differences are stark and consistent. Starting with Ronald Reagan, without exception, the 19 and a half years of Republican presidencies, conservative so-called economic philosophy, has had 19 and a half years, 20 years, of uninterrupted deficits, which have totaled now $4.53 trillion. Those are operating deficits, not the increase of the national debt. I'll get to that, but of operating deficits. The stark comparison between the philosophies pursued by the Clinton administration, and a president really is in charge of that, We are Democrats have taken over the Congress, but we have not been able to pass any real change in economic policy other than, as Winnie, you mentioned, the minimum wage because of the president's veto. Any more than the Republicans were able to make substantial changes because of Clinton's veto. So essentially, presidents get to maintain their economic policy and fiscal policies for the most part. I have been in Congress, as I said, 28 years. No president on spending has had a veto overridden that vetoed a bill for spending too much in those 28 years. In any event, under Bill Clinton, as all of you know, none of you in this room was alive when the last president had 4 years of surpluses in a row, including myself, and I'm maybe the oldest person in the room. Bill Clinton had a $62.9 billion net surplus. Again, the only president in your lifetime who can claim that. The difference was the philosophy that they pursued. I won't pretend that, as I said, that progressive philosophy is perfect or always leads to positive results. Mistakes are made. But when you see the consistency of the failure of the conservative philosophy from Reagan to Bush, the consistency of the facts, it is hard not to conclude that the philosophies themselves are at fault.
And now let's listen in on a conference call with economic experts who will be discussing the $700 billion bailout of Wall Street and what it means both to those on Wall Street but also to those on Main Street, and some of their recommendations for what should be part of the bailout. Thanks very much, Doug, and I want to thank everybody for joining us on this hectic day. I want to just introduce quickly the folks on the call. We're going to have them do 2 to 3 minute introductions each and then quickly turn it over for question and answer. On today's call, Michael Barr, who's a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and also a professor of law at the University of Michigan. We have Michael Ettlinger, who is the Vice President for Economic Policy here at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He was formerly Director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network at EPI. Andrew Jacobovics, who is the Associate Director for the Economic Mobility Program here. And then finally, Ed Paisley, who's the Vice President for Editorial and spent many years as a business and finance journalist. So right now I'm going to turn it over to Ed. He's going to begin, and we'll pass it from one expert to the other, and then, again, quickly open it up for question and answer. And the call today is being recorded. It'll be available on our website just for your information. So for your note-taking, it'll be available for you to listen to after the call. So right now I'll turn it over to Ed.
Okay. I'm going to give a brief, kind of brief introduction to how we got where we are now. In the last few days, kind of looking directly at the legislation that was put forward by Secretary Paulson, and then now what's going on the Hill. As probably you're all aware, on Sunday or over the weekend, Secretary Paulson presented a very thin, bare-boned proposal of how he would spend the $700 billion. And in that proposal, he did not really define who would police how he would spend it, how he would spend it, or in fact, in which way he would purchase the assets to help bail out Wall Street. The Congress reacted, not surprisingly, with a little bit of shock that there weren't enough details in there. And over the past weekend, there's been a lot of work done, still going on today, to try and put more meat on this so that taxpayers and homeowners are protected, as well as helping financial institutions cope with the financial crisis. At this point right now on Capitol Hill, it's pretty fluid, so to say definitively that something is in or out of the draft is very difficult, but I think it's fair to sum up with this. It's clear that that Congress will insist on some kind of accountability mechanism, some kind of oversight supervisory board, so that the Treasury doesn't just spend $700 billion how it pleases, which obviously doesn't work. It's also pretty clear that there will be steps included in this so that individual homeowners in the U.S. housing market, is helped into a recovery process while financial institutions are helped to cope with the problems that they brought on themselves with the manner in which they financed the housing boom, especially over the last 8 years. What will not be in this is obviously steps to make sure it doesn't happen again. Over the past 8 years, there have been a number of serious supervisory missteps that Congress will have to correct and the next administration will have to correct. They're not going to deal with that now. There's not enough time because of the instability of the global markets right now. One final thing to add, something will be in there because they have to delineate it in how the Treasury will go about purchasing these bad debts, these bad mortgages and mortgage-backed securities back from financial institutions so that the taxpayer is not dumped with bad assets that are overpriced because Wall Street and other institutions are trying to dump it on the American people. There will be an auction in place so that the U.S. government takes the lowest price for these bids. I think that sums it up for where we're at now. I'm going to pass it over to Andrew.
Thank you, Ed. Our perspective has always been that the homeowners must be front and center in any of the efforts to stabilize the global credit markets, because ultimately the mortgage-backed assets that are currently in severe distress that the Treasury is considering purchasing obviously are linked to the mortgages that many homeowners are currently having problems making the payments on. And if, in fact, Treasury takes over these assets without any mechanism to restructure those underlying mortgages, basically we're just delaying the inevitable. I mean, it's sort of like, even if Treasury buys the stuff at a discount, it's kind of like getting a cheap upgrade on the Titanic. If you want to think about the fact that until the underlying mortgages are restructured so that they can be sustained, then nothing's going to really happen positively on Wall Street. There may obviously be some rise in the value of those distressed assets over time, but until the American people can actually afford their mortgages, it's unlikely that both the credit will flow back into Wall Street, and as well as the confidence that the underlying assets are, in fact, as valuable as advertised. So with that, I'll turn it over to Michael Barr to give a little more specifics as to how we would potentially address those issues.
Thanks, Andrew. So as Andrew pointed out, the basic thrust of the Treasury plan was really focused on how to move the troubled mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations off the books of financial institutions into the Treasury, but not at all on how to get loan restructuring for homeowners who are facing troubled mortgage loans. And we developed a plan last January and testified on it that would develop a system to let Treasury free up the frozen assets on the books of the financial institutions, like the Treasury plan, but would have embedded in it the key mechanisms needed to get homeowners on firm ground. And there are a few key steps. First, as we proposed last year, Treasury would offer to run a series of auctions to purchase whole mortgages and pools of home mortgages rather than auctions or procedures to get simply an interest in the tranche of securities. Congress would need to revise the tax and accounting rules governing trusts so that servicers and trustees would have a strong incentive and legal capacity to participate in the program. In a particular, real estate mortgage investment conduit status would be denied to trusts that do not permit participation on a voluntary basis in the auctions. And accounting rules would be modified so that asset sales under the program would not trigger any change in their trust status. Once Treasury runs these auctions and takes the assets at the lowest price, the holder, obviously the existing holder of the mortgage, would be taken out. They'd get a steeply discounted value for their asset, but would be able to move forward and clean up their books, get renewed liquidity. A Treasury would cram down second lien holders, home equity lenders, giving them a partial payment so that everybody takes a haircut in the auction and Treasury can clear the way to restructure the troubled loans. Once Treasury has these mortgages, it can restructure eligible loans for owner-occupants of primary residences where necessary. They'd include shared equity approaches so that homeowners share responsibility for any restructuring that takes place. And then Treasury can provide a credit enhancement on these restructured mortgages, get them back into the market, get the global financial system back on its feet. So this plan is a way of helping Wall Street, but also helping Main Street, and really getting to the root cause of the crisis.
Hi.
Let me then turn it over to Michael, the other Michael.
Hi. Thank you, Michael. This is Michael Ettlinger. I'm going to talk a little bit about oversight and accountability. You know, as Ed described, the initial proposal out of Treasury was extremely broad in the authority it gave to the Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, basically, it authorized him to spend $700 billion to buy mortgage-related assets, which are very broadly defined, in almost any matter he saw fit, and conversely also to sell those assets also on any terms that he saw fit. And, you know, he also proposed that his action be non-reviewable in any court or any administrative body. So for several reasons, we think there ought to be a board with some real authority controlling this, not just Paulson. You know, first of all, it's never a good idea to give any single person that much power over that much money. Second, Paulson is from Wall Street. These are his people. The purpose of the plan is to rescue Wall Street, and that's going to be his overriding consideration, as it has been. You know, buying $200 billion worth of assets for $700 billion would certainly rescue Wall Street, but it wouldn't be a very good deal for taxpayers. So there ought to be people formally involved in the decision-making who can, as the deals are cut, evaluate whether the money is being well spent and have the power to put the brakes on if it isn't. Third, the plan authorizes $700 billion, but it's not like there's some scientific formula that is telling us that's the exact right amount. And there are a lot of other things we could be investing in to help our economy, or we could just not be borrowing as much money. So it would be really good. It would be, I think, important to have people overseeing this process who are representing a broader range of perspectives than just Wall Street to make an assessment about whether, as this process goes on, all of the money really needs to be spent. And the last thing is that the other ideas that have been spoken of here, other aspects that should be put into what is done, these are things that Paulson has not embraced, and it seems unlikely that he's going to give them a high priority if he has unilateral power over how the legislation is implemented, even if these things are in the legislation. So in addition to the board, there are other accountability provisions that should be in place. I mean, public reporting, there ought to be transparency as to who's being hired to do the deals for Treasury. Also, it would protect the taxpayers if there were either guarantees as to the value of the assets of some sort or a taxpayer stake in the upside for firms that are being helped out.
And now it's time for a little paparazzi politics when Christy and I talk to you about some of the stories that may not be on the front page, but they should be in the front of your mind. And Christy, you want to get things started off today? What do you got?
Greed, as Gordon Gekko once said, is good. But it turns out that's not the case anymore. I actually, we've got a new thing at the Center for American Progress called I Am Progress. Mm-hmm. It's at iamprogress.org. And mm-hmm. I basically have started putting up movie quotes and scenes from movies every day. So I've got the Gordon Gekko speech from the movie Wall Street up today, talking about how greed is good and Wall Street needs greed to move forward.
Right.
But I think as we've seen recently, that's really not the case with all of the financial mishaps. And I guess mishap is an understated way to say crash and burn flameouts.
Yeah.
And this is some news that, John, you might want to make sure that you're seated. You've got a cold compress ready for your head because this still makes my head ache.
Oh, geez.
ABC News went in this morning and decided to take a look at the top five firms on Wall Street.
Okay.
That's Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley. And they decided to take a look at how these guys treated themselves last year. And it turns out,
and gals,
how these people treated themselves right. last year. And it turns out that last year they paid themselves an end-of-the-year bonus all five together, that equaled $39 billion. That's with a B.
Holy moly.
That's not salary, mind you. That's a $39 billion bonus that they gave to the employees of these top five firms. And when you do the math, of course, some people got a lot and some people got less. But if you do the math saying that everybody got equal, that averages out to $200,000 per person.
That is insane.
Now, keep in mind that the average person in America makes $40,000.
Right.
So when I hear that, that they got this $39 billion worth of bonuses last year, yet the American taxpayer has to take what we get taken out of our $40,000 a year to bail them out, doesn't that just make your head explode?
It's incredible.
And the thing is, it would be one thing for me, I think, if these companies had done a phenomenal job. You know, really made a lot of money, did a lot of really good financial services work. But shareholders last year in just these top five companies, again, we're talking Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley, shareholders in those five firms collectively lost $74 billion in stock declines.
So their shareholders
are
doing terrible.
$74 billion.
Not terrible. Not terrible, but they're losing money.
Lost $74 billion. The companies themselves, Bear Stearns had to have the government buyout, of course. Merrill Lynch just had to get bought out by Bank of America.
Lehman Brothers
is, I think they were bought out. They're going to be allowed to be bought out by Barclays of London.
Right.
But it's thrown the stock market into turmoil. It's crashed the dollar. The price of oil this week actually went up in a single day by $30. It then came back down for a $16 increase, but it's still the highest dollar increase in one day. But greed, not so good. And it just is something to keep in mind, especially, and this is why, John, I think we need to talk about this. The plan that the president right now is trying to push through Congress, that $700 billion bailout. He has two strings he wants attached to it. One is no oversight, which the candidates have all been talking about this week.
Yikes.
Everybody's against it except for, of course, the president and his White House. And the second, and I think just as important, is he wants there to make sure that there is no limit on CEO compensation in the companies that they're bailing out. Meaning he will not say, if you are the head of one of these companies, you don't get your golden parachute. If you're the head of one of these companies, you don't get your $39 billion bonus. And
well, for that and the limits on compensation to executives, both presidential candidates have come out saying that there should be limitations on executive pay.
Exactly. So, but the president is pushing for that in this bailout. So I think that when you hear him talk about it, I know I will still be thinking about the $39 billion signs that keep popping up behind my eyeballs when I close my eyes and think about this.
Just ridiculous. Well, and that leads me very nicely into the next story here. The Washington Post and ABC News have a new poll out today. And I'd like to look specifically at the numbers for the state of Virginia.
Okay.
And
any reason you choose Virginia?
Well, first of all, Virginia has not gone for a Democrat since 1964.
Okay.
Normally a red state, right. But in the last couple election cycles, 2006 when Jim Webb won, Mark Warner's had success there running for Senate this year and is up 30 points in this poll that's out today, actually. It's trending a little bit more purple.
Okay.
Especially because of the areas in northern Virginia, Fairfax County, for example, that have seen an influx of more progressive-minded voters in the last few years. And this poll is really interesting. And going back to what you were just talking about, 50% of people in this poll said that the economy is the number one issue.
Oh, absolutely.
They've been given the choice of 6, 7, 8 different issues, and for 50% of people to say that that's the number one issue is really amazing.
Oh, it's stunning
when you have a choice of 7 or 8 different issues.
Well, and that's like did you see that ABC News poll that came out yesterday? I believe in that poll they asked people if they thought the economy was getting better, staying the same, getting worse. One of those, and the percentage of people who said that the economy was getting better, zero.
Zero.
I have never seen, that's before
amazing.
The margin of error, so it could actually be negative. I have never seen zero as an actual number on a poll. But I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's amazing. And the other thing in this poll in the state of Virginia specifically is that a little bit more than 80% of people said that the country's on the wrong track. Obviously, then the economy, with 50% of people saying the economy is the number one issue, it has a lot to do with it. But some interesting numbers, and I just wanted to tick down them. First of all, overall in Virginia, Obama has a 3-point lead, 49% to 46%.
Okay.
And another interesting thing to look at is they don't just ask you who you're voting for if the election were held today, but they actually ask you how enthusiastic are you about that vote that you would cast.
What's your rah-rah level?
Exactly.
Three cheers, five cheers.
Pom-poms, four pom-poms. And 70% of Obama voters in this poll are enthusiastic. Only 45% of McCain voters are enthusiastic. And that's down from their last poll. Which is interesting because it may be sort of the Palin effect, which a lot of people said, you know, contributed to the enthusiasm of the McCain voter, seems to maybe reach its high point.
Right. It also could be, and, you know, many people have been saying this already, that when, unfortunately, things are going poorly in the Middle East and with our wars, people tend to want to hear what John McCain has to say because Republicans traditionally are stronger or are perceived as stronger on foreign affairs. But when things like this economic crash are happening, Democrats and progressives are traditionally seen as the stronger party with the stronger message for domestic affairs. So it could be that finally voters want to hear what Barack Obama has to say on the economy and healthcare and Social Security and on things that are really going to affect us in the next couple of years directly in the pocketbook.
And in a state like Virginia with a high number of military families, the numbers are laid out here exactly how you just said. So when the pollsters asked, regardless of whom you're voting for, who do you trust more to handle particular issues for the economy, Obama has a 10% lead, 51 to 41. For fixing the problems with major financial institutions, again, another 10% lead for Obama, 49 to 39. If you go down, though, a couple other questions they asked, whether the following statements apply to both Obama and McCain. So you can answer yes to this question for both of them if you'd like. Who would be a good commander-in-chief? 73% of people said McCain. Only 51% said Obama.
Okay.
And then who knows enough about world affairs to serve effectively as president? 74% said McCain. And then again, only 55% said Obama.
Which goes back to what we were just talking about. You know, it's sort of a double trust issue there.
Exactly. So what could be interesting, you know, I think the question is in a state like Virginia, and this mirrors polls that I've seen in a number of other swing states, is the economy what stays on the front page until November 4th?
Right.
Or is there something else?
Well, we'll keep an eye out. You're listening to John Neuroer and me, Christy Harvey, on the Progressive Beat this morning, and we're talking about some stories that you may not have seen on the front page of the paper, but we think are still important. And this is one that, honestly, I can't stop thinking about. I am obsessed with this story.
You're turning red right now.
I'm trying to keep calm. But this was in the Washington Post yesterday, and it was a big story. It was a long story, but it didn't get as much play as I thought it would. The EPA has decided that they are not going to regulate this chemical called perchlorate in drinking water. Perchlorate is a component of rocket fuel. And what happens is when defense contractors and the Pentagon improperly dispose of rocket fuel, you know, basically dump it out the car window instead of doing what they're supposed to, it gets in the drinking water and it harms unborn babies, so pregnant women, carrying babies, newborns, toddlers, and little kids. And
that's
it
terrible.
Messes, it's horrible. It messes with your thyroid gland.
Right.
And it leads to physical problems, mental problems, emotional problems, and a drop in IQ. And it's permanent. It's not something you ever get over.
Right.
So they used to say, the EPA scientists say we need to regulate this. The EPA scientists have said in the past, you can only have one part perchlorate per billion parts of drinking water to be safe. And the EPA brass, the political appointees, have decided that they are not going to regulate because they say, get this, that they're not saying that it's only one part per billion that's safe. They're now saying it's a whopping 15 parts per billion that's safe and that very few places have that much in it. When asked how they got to that number, it turns out the White House and the Office of Management and Budget, which is the strong arm, it's the bodyguard, the bully of the White House.
The non-scientist.
The non-scientists, basically, said, here's the thing. Instead of using the scientific models to come up with your numbers, use this new computer model that we've come up with that gets you different numbers. You know, the one that was put together by the chemical industry that makes perchlorate. So instead of doing what's safe for children, and we're talking up to 40 million kids and pregnant women and other people are exposed to dangerously high levels of this chemical. Instead of saying we're going to fix the problem, they're now saying we reran the numbers using the chemical industry standards and there is no problem. And we've talked about this before, John. This is not the first time the EPA has done something like this. If you remember with mercury, they let the power plants who were polluting write the standards for how much pollution was too much. And the power plants basically said, none. Cool, everybody pollute. They did this before with a chemical called atrazine that's being dumped in the waters that's turning frogs into hermaphrodites and giving them both sex organs, and they have no idea what it's doing to kids, but it could be messing with kids and their hormones. And so we've seen this. They also decided, the EPA, to let the chemical industry test pesticides on toddlers back in the day. They said that was fine. So this is just yet another example of how the EPA has forgotten what the P in their name actually stands for, it seems, and are refusing to protect kids and...
It's protection, for those of you who may not know, by the way.
Right. If you're listening, EPA Chief Stephen Johnson, that's what that P stands for. But it's really a shame, and the EPA scientists are getting very vocal about this. The career scientists who have been studying this, very vocal and very angry about this. So we
seems to be a theme at a number of different agencies. Career scientists getting fired up.
It really is, and so this is going to actually be coming down this week, whether or not the EPA makes that final decision whether or not to set a drinking water safety standard for this rocket fuel. So something definitely, definitely to keep an eye on.
In another case of us being fired up about the incompetency of government in some form or another, how about 2000 in Florida? You remember that? That was awesome.
No, what happened? No.
Yeah.
Speaking of, did you see the miniseries or the made-for-TV movie Recount?
I haven't seen it. And you know what?
It just won an Emmy. This week.
I saw that, but it wasn't on demand. I couldn't find it on demand.
Oh, it's really good. You should watch it.
I wonder, is it because,
talk about getting you
because
fired
they want to sell it? Probably. They want people to buy it.
Quite probably.
Except I'll buy it.
But who do you give that to for Christmas? Hi, here's a DVD.
Something my mom gets me, because she's like, she goes to the bookstore, you know, and it looks at the politics rack, and she just said, oh, he'll like this.
It's really good. Laura Dern as Catherine Harris was awesome.
If you're listening, Mom, sorry. I wasn't trying to make fun of
you. Oh, no. And if you're listening, John's mom, I'd like to actually borrow it to rewatch it after you give it to John for Christmas. So if you'd actually even like to give him two copies, that's good with me. But you were saying, Recount.
Well, this is a quick one, but, and it's not surprising to anybody. Palm Beach County, which was one of the counties where people were slamming on doors and count my vote, and they ended up being congressional staffers that were chipped in. But anyways, Palm Beach County was one of the counties where the recount was ordered. And they're having some more issues. Now, this is frightening. First of all,
it's been 8 years. Get it together.
In 8 years, they've switched their voting system now three times. So this is... For the 2008 election, they're on the third different kind of voting. So it was they went to touchscreen, then they went back, then they went to a different ballot. So now we're on the third different ballot in 8 years and still having problems. So recently they had a local judicial race and they've had problems there with administering the election. And here's a great quote from a county official when asked about the confidence level for the presidential election in 2008. And the official said, managerially, software-wise, procedure-wise, training-wise, there is no confidence that these people will be ready in less than 50 days for the election we're going to have.
Wait, read me that list again.
Okay. So this is the Republican chairman, the Palm Beach County Republican chairman. Managerially, software-wise, procedure-wise, training-wise, there is no confidence that these people will be ready
in less
than 50 days.
But we're confident we will have culinarily wise, we will have good snacks at the. I mean, what's left once you
our
take
abacus
those?
Will be functioning.
Man.
And you know, and this piece, which was on CNN.com, talks about how much money other states have also put into at least attempting to secure.
Oh, like Ohio. Ohio's doing the same thing and still
millions of dollars. Indiana, $67 million. $67 million since 2000 that they've put in Indiana, where at least we didn't hear a lot of problems in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And here's a state, $67 million, and they're still questioning whether or not. In a state like Florida, where a couple weeks ago it looked like McCain had it pretty much under control, he was up by 6 or 8, and you would think, okay, well, maybe it's not going to be an issue, like in 2004 when Bush won.
Yeah, it seems like it was set, you know, the
handily. The polls this week are a dead heat in Florida. So fantastic.
November 5th is going to be very interesting. As long as I never have to hear the words hanging Chad again, I think I'll be okay.
Well, I mean, I think what we should do is start taking bets on, they have those futures markets. So you should start taking bets on whether or not, you know, yes or no, we'll know who the president of the United States is on November 5th.
I can't believe you're trading futures in electoral politics.
Okay, well, I'm not.
You're like a hedge fund trader
for money. not after what I've seen the last couple weeks. No more money is going into those.
This is Christy Harvey. You're listening to John Neuroir and I on the Progressive Beat. And this is one that I thought was even funnier. Funny in a sort of sad and depressing way.
Funny and frightening.
funny and I don't mean in the ha-ha way. the Southern Baptist Convention has decided to yank this month's issue of Gospel Today. Now, Gospel Today is the largest Christian magazine in the country. And the Southern Baptist Convention has all of these bookstores around the country.
Right,
and this is their big magazine for people who want Christian magazines. And they have decided to take this issue and hide it behind the counter. And in order to get this month's issue, you have to, you know, sidle up to the clerk and say, psst, hey, you got any of that Gospel Today back there for me?
Even at 7-Elevens, you can see the nudie mags. They're in the back rack, but you can see them.
They haven't said,
not
I haven't
that
seen.
I've looked, but.
They haven't said whether or not they've wrapped them in paper, but get why this is happening. The Baptists are very upset because this month's issue of Gospel Today, get this.
Mm-hmm.
On its front cover,
right,
has a photograph of lady pastors.
With clothes on, right?
Oh, yeah. They're all wearing black ministerial garb.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. No. With clothing, this isn't bum chicken wow wow country. No, they're just angry.
Baptist babes.
They're just angry.
Sorry.
That the magazine would dare to put on its front cover women in the position of ministering. Because they say that runs completely counter to its beliefs. They don't believe that women should be allowed to be pastors. They don't believe women should be able to minister the Southern Baptist Convention. And they're furious that this magazine, which is not a Baptist magazine, it's a Christian magazine,
right,
that this magazine would dare to highlight women ministers. And Gospel Today's publisher is not happy about this and has said, basically, they're treating it like pornography.
Yikes.
So if you would like this, I sort of want everybody to go out there and just flood these Southern Baptist Convention bookstores and just take all of these magazines that they've hidden behind the counters and make sure that they sell this month, because that just, for some reason, just infuriates me.
You should buy it, and you should take it from behind the counter, buy it, and then sneak back to the magazine rack. And put it right in the front.
And, yep, put it in front of Cosmo or any of the other magazines they have in there. It just makes me a little mad.
Cosmo? I think not.
Okay. All right.
All right. Well, I have one that's a fun one to finish with, but I saw this and I couldn't resist.
Speaking of pornography.
In some ways, yeah. A candidate in British Columbia, in Canada, running for parliament, had to apologize Sunday for removing his clothes in front of minors at an environmental retreat 12 years ago.
Oh.
He said in a statement that he made a serious error in judgment by shredding his clothes.
Why did he take his clothes off? Were they at least like outside at a swimming hole or something? Or was this at like the lobby of the Marriott?
Well, apparently police received complaints. This is 12 years ago from this camp that he was at, an environmental camp.
And when you say environmental, are you putting that in quotes? Does that mean like nudist colony?
No, I don't think so.
Right.
I mean, there are no quotes here, and I think that they really mean an environmental camp. But here's why. Well, this is the reason given.
Here's
not saying this is excusing it.
Okay.
But he said he dropped his shorts in front of a group of teens and asked them to paint his body.
Oh.
Well, they want to be one with the earth.
No. There's plenty of ways to be one with the earth without having to paint the nude parliamentarian's body.
So a 1996 newspaper article that surfaced on the internet reports that the police investigated allegations that he removed his clothes in front of the teens at the retreat. And then, apparently then he went skinny dipping.
To wash the paint off?
I guess. Well, it probably wasn't paint. It was mud. It was like earthy and...
Oh, very hippy-dippy. Okay, well, here's my hint to you. If you decide that you one day want to run for parliament, make sure to keep your shorts on next time you go to camp. And if you decide you want more stories like this, please try to log on to www.miccheckradio.org. This is just the tip of the iceberg of all of the stories you need to know to be a lot smarter today.
Nice transition there. And that's the show for today. Thanks for listening. For my co-host, Christy Harvey, I'm John Neuroer, and this has been The Progressive Beat.